This week on the Best of Public Radio, NHPR partners with the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Earlier this month, The Giver opened in theaters around the country. Based on the novel by Lois Lowry, it examines the importance of memory to individuals and to cultures. Lowry stepped up to the podium in Teterboro recently to discuss her craft and her penchant for memories and dreams.
I started my morning this morning. Well, we all started it with music. Wasn't that lovely? But I started it earlier than that, the way I start every morning. This time in the Jack Daniel's Motor Inn, which has Wi-Fi, by opening my iPad and answering my email. I get an enormous amount of email every single day, most of it from kids. It's easy to reach an author, any author, I assume, by going to their website, and that's how kids find me. I have brought with me to read to you an exchange of emails between me and a child. This was not this morning's. This took place over the course of several days, a couple of years ago. So her first email to me, her name is Chrissy, said, "I do not think that this is a kid's book. It has stuff kids should not read about in it." And then there are many exclamation points. That was her email in its entirety. So I replied, "I don't know which book of mine you are talking about, Chrissy. I have written many books. But I think kids should know about everything and that reading books is a great way to learn. Lois Lowry." She replied after a couple of days, "I am talking about Anastasia Has the Answers. It talks about bad things." I replied, "I can't think of a single bad thing in that book." She replied, "It talks about sex, so I think you might want to read your own book again." To which I replied, "Well, I took your advice, Chrissy, and I looked all through Anastasia Has the Answers, and I didn't find a single thing in it that could be described as bad. It does use the word sex in a scene where Anastasia tries to convince her English teacher to use the book Gone with the Wind in English class, and he says he thinks it's inappropriate. But surely that isn't what you meant. And it uses the word sexy when Anastasia's friend paints her toenails and announces that she thinks they look sexy. Surely that isn't what you meant. So I have to disagree with you, I'm afraid. I don't think there's a single bad thing in the book, and I'm happy to have my own grandchildren read it." She replied, "It also talks about a girl liking another girl. I mean, it happens in life, but you do not need to put that stuff in kids' books." To which I replied, "Chrissy, it talks about a girl worrying because she sort of has a crush on her female gym teacher. You're right that such things do happen in real life. And in the book, the girl talks to her mother about it and is reassured that she is perfectly normal. I think it is valuable for kids, readers, to know that A, one can talk about such things with mom, and B, that such feelings are normal. Sometimes a book is a very comfortable way to think about such things. Sometimes it is good to read a book with your mom and talk about it. With love, Lois Lowry." She replied, "Okay, I do not like this book, and you do not have to take my advice, but I absolutely hate this book. Oh, and P.S., never ever send me anything again, and do not say with love." That was the end of our correspondence, because I followed her instructions and never, ever sent her anything again. But you can tell from my description what the passage was about. A 13-year-old girl has a crush on her gym teacher. For me, it was a camp counselor. She is embarrassed telling her mother about it, and so she phrases it, "This girl I know she has a crush on." And her mother, being a warm, compassionate, intelligent mother, has the conversation without having to identify the girl. And at the conclusion of the conversation, the mother says, I think she's probably a warm, sensitive, loving girl. I think I would like her a whole lot. And Anastasia says, "If you knew her." And the mother says, "Yes, of course, if I knew her." The Anastasia series of books was written and published some years ago, and they're about to be republished. There are 9 of them. And they're all in that vein, and they're lighthearted books that deal with sensitive issues often in a lighthearted fashion. One time, I was reading an interview with an author now dead who has always been a great favorite of mine, the Canadian author Robertson Davies. In particular, I love his trio of books called the Deptford Trilogy. Davies was asked a question in this interview about his ability to marry, to combine humor and tragedy so brilliantly in these books. And he answered very cryptically. And he didn't elucidate upon his answer. And I don't know how many other people understood his answer, but I did. What he said was, humor is simply a way of sending the dogs in a different direction. And when I read that, a book floated into my mind and my memory. And that book was The Yearling, written by Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings. My mother read The Yearling to me when I was 8 years old. It had been published as an adult book, and I think it might have been a Book of the Month Club selection and ended up that way in our house. And she read it to my sister and me at bedtime, but my sister opted out early on, said, boring, and retreated to her own bedroom and closed the door, and Mother read to me in my room this book that changed my view of literature. It's hard to say why, except that it allowed me to enter a world that was adult and that had tragedy in it and sadness and grief. I'd been reading Mary Poppins, which I had loved, and Nancy Drew, which I had loved. I had no particular sophisticated taste in literature in those days. But suddenly I was plunged into a world that was different. And on top of that, there was a chapter in the book, and our copy had the NCYF paintings as illustrations, which so enhanced it. There's a chapter in the book where the boy's father, and this is set in a Florida swamp for those three of you who have never read it or don't remember it, in a very poor area of western Florida. And the boy's father is bitten by a rattlesnake. And the Wyeth painting shows the father in a bed with a patchwork quilt. The doctor is nodding off beside the bed. The doctor was a bit of an alcohol user. That was an adult thing in a book my mother read to an eight-year-old child. And the boy I so identified with, his name was Jody. He was my age. He looked like me in those paintings. He's seated on the floor, leaning his head against the bed. And we don't know, the boy doesn't know, whether his father will live or die. My mother read that chapter to me, and it concludes with, in the voice of the boy, or speaking of the boy, said he was filled with hate for all death and pity for all aloneness. And when my mother read that sentence, she began to cry, and I'd never seen my mother cry before. I didn't understand then what I did in later years when I thought about that moment. It was 1945. I was 8. My sister was 11. My little brother was 2 years old. And my father was on an island in the Pacific. The war had not yet ended. My mother was alone with three children. And that was what she wept for herself. Pity for all aloneness, hate for all death. It's what a book can do, I think, to bring the feelings out of the book into the heart of the person who is reading or hearing it. And that's what that book did for me and why I remember it so fondly. But at any rate, there I was in this house with my teacher, who was 6 years old, my mother, who was a reader to us all the time, and a house filled with books. I was born in Honolulu because of my father's work. My father was not a professional photographer, but a very fine photographer with the best possible cameras and always a dark room in our house. We had always, as children, home movies that were much better than the average home movie, which usually consists of people going like this. But my father was a very gifted photographer and had good equipment, and we had very fine home movies. And as children in those days before television, That was often our entertainment. Dad would get out the big movie projector. Sometimes the film would come off the reel and we'd have to wait while he put it back on. He taught me to use his splicing machine. And he would show the movies of us as younger children. And if we asked him to, he would show some scenes backwards so that mother pouring the orange juice, suddenly the orange juice would fly back in the picture. These days of television and computer-generated graphics make that all seem so innocent long ago. But one of the movies that we saw often and that I had always remembered very fondly was of me on the beach in Waikiki. And I was born in 1937. So this was long before there were hotels on that beach, with the exception of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, which had been built earlier. But the beach is deserted. It's empty, and there's just me, and there's the water lapping at the beach. The film was in color. The color over the years has faded, but I remember its original color, and the sky is blue, and the water is blue, and the sand is golden. And I'm wearing a kind of a sunbonnet that a breeze catches and starts to pull off my head, and I laugh and grab it and pull it back. I'm 3 years old. Hold that scene in your mind, because I'm going to return to it in a minute, or maybe 10 minutes, because it's an important scene in what I want to try to describe. I began school not in Hawaii, but in Pennsylvania, because, of course, the war had begun by the time I was 5 and 6 years old. And my mother, when my father went overseas, my father was a career Army officer, took her children, and she was expecting the third, who would turn out to be my baby brother, back to her hometown, a small college town in Pennsylvania, and we went to live with our grandparents. I later wrote the book called Autumn Street, which remains one of my favorites, perhaps because I'm the main character. But it's autobiographical. I've called myself Elizabeth in the book, and my sister Jessica, though those weren't our names. But this is a description, an accurate description of my first day of school. My sister took me to school for my first day in first grade. My mother was home with a baby. Kind of surprises me now that mom didn't take me for my first day, but this was a very small town. The school was 3 blocks from our house. It was the same school my mother had attended. I think some of the teachers who had taught her may still have been there. And so off I went with my sister. And on the way, as it describes, children across the street call to my sister. And they say, "Walk with us, Jess." And she says, "I can't. I have to take my sister in. Tomorrow I'll walk with you." "Jess," I said, "you mean you won't walk with me tomorrow?" "Elizabeth, you're a first grader. I can't walk to school with a first grader every day. You'll find somebody your own age to walk with. Now look, this is the door we go in. I go upstairs to fourth grade, but the first grade room is right here. Over there are the bathrooms. That's the boys. This is the girls. If you have to go to the bathroom, you have to ask the teacher first." I clung to her arm and could tell that she was eager to leave me. "Jess," I whispered, "you mean I have to tell the teacher if I have to go to the bathroom?" "Yes, let go of me." "I can't tell the teacher that." "Well, be a camel then. Now let go. I can't be late." She pried me loose, pushed me into the first grade room, and a tall young woman in a flowered dress knelt beside me so that her face was level with mine, and she was smiling. "Good morning," she said. "Did you come all alone on the very first day?" "Yes," I lied. "My goodness, you're very brave. Most children need to have their mothers bring them, and even then," she lowered her voice to a whisper, "even then some of them cry. I'm so glad to have a big girl like you in my class. Would you like to sit here and look at some books while I greet the other children?" I nodded. First grade didn't seem so bad after all. The shelves around the room were filled with books. My grandfather's house was also filled with books. His were the leather-bound kind, the classics. He used to read Kipling to me when I lived there in that house as a small child. There's another moment in this book when the two sisters, and I would have been 6 and she 9, sharing a bedroom, are in bed at night talking to each other. And finally it says, "Good night, Jess," I whispered, but she was already asleep, breathing softly. I realized then for the first time that her dreams would always be different from mine. I included that passage because it's something else, along with the scene on the beach and the child with the wind blowing her hat, the scene of the two sisters and the different dreams is something I want to come back to in a minute. Okay, I'm going to jump over a little story I was going to tell you. Me at age 8, but I realize I'm not going to have time to go through all of this, so I'm going to jump ahead to age 10. And the two stories, age 8 and 10, were both pretty much the same thing and had to do with my beginning to perceive the power that fiction can have. So, jumping over age 8, I'm now age 10. I'm sent off to a summer camp for 2 months in the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania. I am a very shy child, introverted, quiet. But I'm also, and this is true, I think, of most writers, and even at that time, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I was very observant. I always perceived everything that was going on, even things that adults hoped I wouldn't. But here I am at summer camp, a girls' camp. The counselors, the girls who took care of us, were college girls. And I perceived early on in that experience that as they asked questions of the young campers, my peers, they were more interested in and more attentive to the little girls who had older brothers in college. I'm not sure I perceived why that was, but it was clear to me. And therefore, when I was asked about my family back in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, I described my little brother, who was 4. I described my sister, who was 13, and they were both real. But then I went on to say, and I have a brother who goes to college. And it worked. They were interested in that. They weren't interested in Johnny, who was 4, or Helen, who was 13. But they said, oh, what is your brother's name? I said, David. It was just a name I liked. And then they said, where does he go to college? What college does he go to? Now, 10, I had little knowledge of colleges. But I had an uncle, a great uncle, actually, my grandmother's younger brother, who just a short time before this had been the talk of the family because he was an avid, devoted Princeton graduate. In fact, when he died, close to 100, he was still going back to reunions, and he was the oldest doddering graduate there. But he had just been a bit of a scandal because his daughter had to reschedule her wedding when he discovered that it conflicted with his Princeton reunion, and he was going to attend that instead of the wedding. So the wedding was rescheduled, but everybody was buzzing about Uncle Fulton and Princeton. So what college does he go to? Princeton. Well, that was a coup. They really loved me then. Do you think he might come and visit you this summer? He might. He might. He said he might. Does he have a car? Yes. A convertible, I said. I began to picture him myself. I knew he wasn't real, but I began to feel that he was real. I could feel his personality, his blonde hair blowing in the breeze as he... Part of that came from Nancy Drew and her boyfriend. Well, there's no happy or unhappy ending to this story because I was never outed. I spent 2 months at that camp. Sadly, David never got there for a weekend visit, but I never lost my popularity. You know, there's no conclusion to this story except I'm telling it again and again and again because it's one of the moments in which I was beginning to feel the power of storytelling. But fiction writing was always my love. It has always been more difficult to publish fiction than nonfiction. There's less market for it, even less now than there was then. Then there were still some magazines that published fiction. Now there are very few, the New Yorker still being one. In 1975, I lived in Maine. My children were all school age. It was a fall morning, early November, and I went out, the kids had all gone off to school. My husband had gone off to his law office. I went out to the back porch to scrape the leftover breakfast into the dog's dish. And I stopped for a moment because in the way such things do, the smell of the air brought back a memory. It was November. There were dead leaves, of course, on the ground and some still, I suppose, in the trees. We had apple trees. There were shriveled apples hanging. They'd frozen and turned brown, but their smell lingered. There were my children's Halloween pumpkins still on the porch, and there was wood smoke coming out of chimneys of houses nearby, and all of that combination of smells reminded me of a day when I was 9 years old. And I went back into the house and to my typewriter, the same typewriter I had taken to college when I was 17, and I wrote the story of that day. It was a day in which my father, newly returned from World War II, had taken me off on an excursion for the day, and I was frightened of him. He was a stranger to me. In retrospect, I realized the reverse was also true. I was a stranger to him. So it's a story of reconciliation. All stories, incidentally, are that. But this one was a short story. Its first sentences were, "It was morning early, barely light, cold for November. I was 9 and the war was over. In the car, I sat next to the stranger who was my father." I sent the story off to Red Book magazine, which still exists, no longer publishes fiction, but if you want to know what the best makeup is or clothes or how to conduct your sex life, Red Book is the place to go. But in those days, they published fiction and they published this story. And after it was published, I got a letter from an editor at Houghton Mifflin asking if I had ever considered writing for kids and would I consider writing a book for young people for Houghton Mifflin. The story was for adults, but it was seen through the eyes of a child. And so with that invitation from a major publisher, which happens rarely to a writer to be invited to write a book, although they did not promise to publish it, I did sit down and write my first book. And I drew on, as writers often do, my own experience. And I think it was a story that I'd been carrying around for a long time, looking for a place to put it down and a way to place it there. And it was the story of the death of my sister, my first teacher, my best friend, my worst enemy, my sidekick, my partner in crime often. She had died young. And so I told that story from the point of view of the younger surviving sister. Incidentally, when the book was published, I sent a copy to my parents who were still living and to my brother, whom I had left out of the book. I had put him in at first, and I realized he was a distraction. Little brothers in literature are also often cute and amusing, but it wasn't an amusing story, and he was a distraction, so I'd revised it and removed him. The first book was published, and then a number of other books were published, including Autumn Street. My mother, in her 80th year, had a stroke. They lived in Virginia near my brother, and she was hospitalized for a while. And then they had done all they could for her medically, and so she was not able to come home because her mind had gone elsewhere and she needed a lot of care. And so she was in a nursing home near where my father still lived in their house. And I would go down to visit as often as I could. And one day, she never recognized me or my brother. And she also would laugh and laugh about things that we weren't privy to, or she would weep. And we didn't know why she was so sad. But one day, she began to cry and cry. And she kept saying over and over, "I'm so sad, Dorothy's baby has died." My brother didn't remember this, but I remembered that when I was 13, and my brother would have been 7, my mother's best friend was a woman named Dorothy, and her husband Jim was my dad's best friend. And we saw a lot of them, and they had no children, and then suddenly Dorothy was expecting a baby, and we were all very excited, and mother began knitting little baby sweaters. But Dorothy and Jim's baby was born, a boy, and it only lived 4 days. So clearly, that's what she was talking about. But when we said to her, or I said to her, remembering that, I said, "Mother, are you seeing Dorothy, or are you remembering Dorothy?" And she looked at me as if I were an idiot, and she said, "In the dream world, that doesn't matter." And that began to trigger, and it's why I read you that little passage where the girl says, "I realized that her dreams would always be different from mine," began to trigger in me fascination with the subject of dreams. I had always also been fascinated by the subject of memory. I think because both things are so individual, nobody else has the same dreams that you do. and nobody else has your memories. If you and your twin brother go to the same party, you're going to remember it differently, even though your genetic material may be the same. They're completely individual and personal, and I guess that's why they're so fascinating to me. But dreams continued to be a fascination, and eventually I wrote this book, which is called Gossamer. And indeed, I eventually adapted it to the stage, and I've seen it performed in a number of different cities. But it's a fantasy, really, and it's about small creatures, made-up creatures, who are translucent and very small. It was difficult to do that on the stage, but different stage designers found ways of doing it. And they are the creatures who come into your house or mine at night while we're sleeping, and magically, by touching the things that are part of your history or your present, accumulate, gather fragments of your life, and then flutter. In the book, they can kind of hover, and they can levitate, and then they breathe the dreams into the ear of the sleeping person. They couldn't levitate on the stage. They found other ways of doing it. But at any rate, the book, the main character in the fantasy part of the book, because the book also includes the lives of the people who are receiving the dreams, but in the fantasy element, the main character is a very small beginning dream giver, and she's being taught, and she's been assigned an elderly woman in whose house she is to gather these fragments and bestow, as they call it, these dreams. And she's speaking to her mentor, the elderly dream giver who is teaching her, and she's describing a stuffed donkey that had apparently been the woman's during her childhood and was in the attic, and the woman has, for reasons that are described, brought it down, and it's in her bedroom, and so the little dream giver has touched this stuffed donkey. And so she describes to her teacher, the donkey was part of the woman's childhood, part of her story. Once there was a little girl and she had a toy donkey, would be the way her story begins. I already knew her story from the things I'd collected. It's a long story and it has sad parts. I get a lot of sad fragments from a photograph of a soldier. Feelings of never coming back. Feelings of now I'm all alone. But a kiss is there too in that photograph, so I always collect there just to keep that kiss fragment for her. And you know what? Sad parts are important. If I ever get to train a new young dream giver, that's one of the things I'll teach, that you must include the sad parts because they're part of the story and they have to be part of the dreams. You'll be a good teacher one day, he told her. Thank you, she said. But he added, you must stop sucking your thumb, she sighed. I know, soon I will. So that is the book Gossamer and my revisiting of the theme of dreams. And it leads me to my father now, 90 years old, mother has died, dad's in a nursing home, and I go to visit him, and I turn the pages of a photograph album, and he looks at a picture of two little blonde girls, and he says, oh, there you are with your sister. And then he says, I can't remember her name. And I said, Helen, Dad, she was named for her grandmother. And he says, whatever happened to her? And I have to tell him of her death, which has happened 70 years before, but he's forgotten it, and he's devastated. And I turn the pages, and we look at other pictures, and there are houses we've lived in, and a car that he loved, Chrysler 300, best car I ever had. But then there's a picture again of two teenage girls, and he says, there you are with your sister. And then he says, I can't remember what happened to her. And I had to tell him again, she died, Dad. And when I was driving my rental car back to the airport to go home, and it was time to write a new book, but a new book hadn't yet come to me, I thought about that, and I thought about memories and how they serve us, and what would it be like if we could expunge the things that made us sad or scared. And I began to concoct a story which took much greater form when I began to put it on the page. But by the time I got home, I had decided to write a book about a community of people who had found a way to manipulate human memory. And therefore, everybody was very comfortable and happy because nobody had to remember anything sad. Of course, the book, which was called eventually The Giver, becomes much more than that. But that was the starting point of it. That's where I want to return to the image I asked you to hold in your head of the little girl on the beach. Because when my father was probably 75, for his birthday, I took the big tin cans that had held those old movies, which were beginning to smell bad as they deteriorated, and I took them to MIT and had them transferred onto videotape. And then for a while, before I gave them to my father and mother, I tortured some of my friends who, every time they're in my house, I would say, "You want to see the picture of me?" And I made friends look at these old videos. They were good sports about it. It was not as bad as people's slideshows of their vacation to European capitals. Any rate, my friends John and Nancy Devereaux were at my house, and John was a lawyer in Boston, but he had been, prior to that, he'd been a nuclear submarine captain. And so he knew Hawaii. He had been there, stationed there. And so we got to that part, the little girl on the beach, the wind blows her bonnet. Everybody says, "Oh, isn't that cute?" And then it moves on to the next scene, which is the two little sisters holding a big watering can, watering flowers in our yard in Honolulu. But John says, "Stop it and rewind. I want to see that scene on the beach again." And so I did. And there he pointed out what had always been there and what I had never seen before. The little girl, again, laughs, grabs her hat. But on the horizon, as she's doing that, moving slowly along, is a misty, a kind of vague but clear. That's an oxymoron, isn't it? It's shrouded in mist, but it's quite clear, the outline. And it's a ship moving along the horizon. And it's identifiable. I've gone back to photographs and confirmed this, but John said, looking at it, he said, "That's the Arizona." Okay, so now we have the little girl laughing on the beach. And behind her, we have a ship carrying 1,200 men, all of whom will be dead in a few months because that ship is going into Pearl Harbor, where it will be bombed in December. And to me, that encapsulates what I'm trying to say, and trying to say in the book, The Giver, that these things combine and create what makes us human, that our lives consist of this broad spectrum of things. And if we obliterate the Arizona, and nowadays, somebody with Photoshop could take that out easily. I could do it myself. But if we do, we lose so much if we give up what causes us pain. And in the book, The Giver, it deals with that. These people have discarded what makes us human, and they've lost art, literature, music, all of these things that arise out of deep emotions and often anguish. The Giver was published in 1993, I think, that won the Newbery Medal in 94, and it's become one of those iconic books that each generation has of anti-establishment. For me, it was The Catcher in the Rye, published when I was 14 years old in 1951. For my kids, I think it was Vonnegut, Slaughterhouse-Five, maybe Joseph Heller with Catch-22. These are the books that make young people acknowledge that their parents' generation hasn't gotten it right. And it gives them something to move ahead for in the hope that they will. And I think books like those I write and others should nurture that hope in young people, that they can make it right. I want to close with reading you one thing. This is a letter that my son wrote to me. I don't remember what year, but he was a fighter pilot in the Air Force. I lost that son. That would be one of the memories I would lose if my memories were manipulated. He died in the military. But before that, he had been demonstrating the F-15, a fighter plane, at an air show in England. And he wrote me this letter after that. It says, "I had gone first, so I was finished flying, was walking around, still in my flight suit, carrying my helmet, heading for the VIP tent for a cup of coffee. Typical English day, cloudy, drizzling occasionally, and there were thousands of people there. The Brits really love their air shows. People kept stopping me and asking me to sign their programs." Parentheses, he says, "Sometime, Mother, you'll have to explain this autograph thing to me. What do they do with those autographs?" While I was signing one for someone, I noticed out of the corner of my eye a little boy about 8 years old watching me, holding his program. His parents were nudging him to come forward to get an autograph, but he kept shaking his head and looking at the ground. He was too shy. So I said to him, "Would you like me to sign your program?" And he said, "Oh, please, sir." And although I'd been managing just fine, doing a juggling act up till then, I said, "Would you mind holding my helmet for me while I sign my name?" He took my helmet. I signed his program, which only took a second, and then I glanced back at him and saw that he wasn't looking at me, but at my helmet in his arms, and he was stroking it. I was almost overwhelmed with the sudden awareness of what that helmet meant to him, that what I symbolized to him, that I was a hero to that little boy, to others like him. And I found myself saying, as I took my helmet back, "You know, I think I wore out my gloves on today's flight, and I'll have to get new ones. Would you like to have these?" And he said, "Oh, please, sir." And I gave him my perfectly good pair of gloves and said goodbye. And as I walked away, I thought, "Lowry, you jerk, those were $75 gloves." But throughout the rest of the day, walking around, occasionally I saw that little boy, and all day long he was wearing the gloves. They were enormous on his little hands. And every time I saw him, I thought how lucky I was to have had that encounter with that child. I think most people go through their whole lives without ever having a moment like that, when they become aware of what they represent. I think he told me about that because he knew that I have those moments every day when I open that email, even if it's a little girl who says, "Never contact me again," because she's at a moment in her life when she's groping to grow up. And somewhere along the line, I felt a strong parental influence on her emails, by the way. I think a mother was looking over her shoulder and said, "Say this, say that." But along the line for that child, as she gets older and matures, she will be affected by what she reads. And some of those books will be by me. And I feel an enormous responsibility to those children and a great debt of gratitude to them and to all of you. Thank you.
In a minute, Lois Lowry will take questions from the audience. You're listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on the Best of Public Radio from NHPR.